Well, welcome everyone to another Nexus webinar. I'm your host, Andrew Estes, and today I'm excited to welcome Mark Moore, a well-known author, speaker, professor, and teaching pastor at Christ Church of the Valley in Peoria, Arizona. Mark joined the staff there back in July of 2012. Initially founded by Don Wilson, CCV now has over 48,000 people in regular attendance across 18 thriving campuses all across the Phoenix Valley and beyond as they continue to reach lost people for Christ. Prior to joining CCV, Mark was a professor at Ozark Christian College, my alma mater, back in Joplin, Missouri, for nearly 22 years, I believe. And he is also the author and co-author of several books, including the hugely popular Core 52 series and his most recent book, which we're going to unpack today, The Master Leader, 12 Ways to Lead Like Jesus. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's an honor.
So grateful for this. I'd love to just maybe start before we dive into the book, just a little bit of your background, even beyond just the 22 years at Ozark, the almost 13 years at CCV. Just give us a little bit of more background about who you are, some of the things that you've been able to be a part of.
Yeah, I hail from the West Coast, born in Portland, but grew up in Sacramento. My grandfather was a church planter, kind of like what you guys are doing at Nexus, way back in the day. He was actually born in 1876.
Wow.
So he planted over a dozen churches in Northern California and Southern Oregon. I never knew it. So it wasn't like I'm, you know, following in his footsteps. My call was completely separate and unrelated to his. In fact, my dad took me to an old revival meeting. It's probably 13, 14. And I'd always kind of heard stories of my grandfather and, you know, what a powerhouse he was. And this preacher, man, he was all hellfire and brimstone. And it just turned me off. My dad, however, loved it. And I remember walking out, he put his hand on our shoulders and said, "Boys, you've just heard your grandfather preach." And it was just like, it was heartbreaking to me because I knew I didn't want to approach, that just wasn't native to how I wanted to approach evangelism or preaching. In fact, I didn't even want to be a preacher until later I got the call. And when I did, I was looking for a school that was known for creating preachers. And Ozark, I don't think it's the only school that creates great preachers. Obviously, there's plenty of those. But God led me to that place at that time. And it was his hand on my life. At Ozark, I planned on doing mission work in Latin America. Went down to San Antonio after post-graduation to do that. And after my master's degree, they called me back. Honestly, Andrew, this is how dumb I was. I thought they were asking me to be a consultant for a center that would help disadvantaged students. And then the dean at the time said, "Well, you'll probably need to look for housing too." And I hung up the phone and I thought, housing? He's talking about a job. So it worked out. 22 years training leaders like yourself to go into ministry and make an impact. And then at the 22-year mark, I met Don Wilson at a gas station in Durango, Colorado. So I'm walking down the hill from a CIY conference. I'm going to go do some writing. We had never met. I knew who he was. What I didn't know is he had been asking around his youth pastor, his son, like, who's a guy that could be a teaching pastor for us? And my name kept coming up. So I come up behind him and say, "Hey, mister, can you loan me a dollar?" And he is so sharp. He recognized my voice from the sermons that he had listened to, turned around and said, "No, but we need to talk." And so he laid out this vision for the Leadership Institute, for preaching on the weekend, and for young adult ministries. And that's kind of my thinking was I could spend half my life in the academy and then the other half of my life in the church. And it just felt balanced. And here's the truth. Some of the young guys coming up through Ozark, guys that I had, you know, invested in, discipled, Shane Wood and Michael DeFazio, Mike Ackerman, Jim Dalrymple. I'm going, you know what? They're going to be better than me, but they don't know it yet. So if I leave now, I can get out before they realize I'm crashing and burning. So that's my story so far.
Yeah, that's awesome. Tell me just a little bit about so your role as teaching pastor at CCV, what does that kind of entail?
I have a stupid, crazy fit job for me. So what it entails is I go in the office and I look around and say, okay, what needs to be done today? What that I want to do. And that's what I do. I preach on the weekends about once a month. I do a lot of staff training. I do a lot of kind of theological development. Case in point, we just did a marriage series on for the last 5 weeks. Incredibly impactful. But what we never touched on people living together. So I have already invested in some thinking through that, the sociological implications. Even if you weren't a Christian, I would say it's a bad idea. In fact, non-Christian therapists and counselors say it's a bad idea. So just having that at the ready to unpack that in a biblical manner, but also a sociologically helpful manner for couples. We're gonna put it out on video this week for social media and other resources for our associate pastors. So just stuff like that. Help where I can.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. Well, I came across your book at the end of last year called The Master Leader, right? So you went, yeah. I believe that came out at the end of last year, like October timeframe. Is that about right?
Actually, there's a backstory, Andrew.
Okay. The
previous edition, I think it goes back to 2018.
Wow. Okay.
And I was asked to speak at a conference, multiple sessions on leadership. And so I'm just data dumping, you know, after teaching for, you know, once you're an old dude, you got to have a deep well. So I'm pulling this stuff out. I didn't even edit it much, but it came out to 80 pages. And I thought, well, shoot, like, what's the easiest way to get this in these guys' hands? So College Press Publishing graciously put it together. And honestly, I did a pretty poor job of all the editing of it. So former student Chad Harrington got that manuscript. And he said, man, it's out of print. Can I reprint it? And I said, absolutely not. It's a piece of junk. I don't want my name on that. So give me 6 months to edit it. And so I started editing it. I've got it all up on the whiteboard, all the ideas that I had at that time. It was still called The Master Leader, but I had these, it's all data dump on the board. One of our executive pastors, Jeff Osborne, is an incredibly astute leader, no formal Bible training. He knows the Bible well, but he knows business. Like, he's an expert. I brought him on my office. And I said, okay, help me think through this. Really what I wanted him to do was pat me on the back and say, this is good. And he said, yeah, that's not good. He said, your biblical stuff is phenomenal. But honestly, Mark, my business guys would get two pages into it and go, TMI, I'm out. They want the down and dirty. What do I need right now to be a leader? So that's where this idea came of Jeff coming alongside. And at one point, he was making so many editorial suggestions. I'm going, I can't do that. Why don't you do that? And let's do this thing together. So that's really how that came about and turned out to be a pretty good project for both of us. I'm proud of the way it looks now, in no small part to Jeff's contribution, because here's our goal. Sorry, I know I'm monologuing here, but I want to lay this out so that everyone listening can really see the value of this. We have created a book to help pastors be better at business and business leaders be better pastors in their business. And it's been field tested on both sides, in the church and in businesses. If you want a book that as a pastor you can give to your key leaders to help them pastor better in their businesses, and they kind of help coach and mentor you in the business practices of the church, this is a real win for both sides of the equation.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that, just because, yeah, the formatting of what Jeff and just the history and everything that he brings from his own experience, like you go in and you'll every chapter you kind of introduce a topic and then Jeff gets a few pages to talk about that concept in the business world and from a faith-based perspective. And then you pause on that and then just really unpack that characteristic or character trait in the life of Christ and love being so chapter by chapter introduction, Jeff talks, and then you unpack just the biblical foundation for all of that. And I love that. I'd love for you to just share a little bit about the tension, because so many times I feel like I hear about, you know, church leaders say like business principles are for business, like we're a church, and there's often a tension in leadership books and leadership conversations in the church world. Can you just share maybe a little bit about maybe that misunderstanding or just the tension? Like, is there relevance there? Is there weight there? What are some of the things that people are most afraid of when we're having that conversation?
Yeah. Andrew, let me take a broader view of your question, because this applies not only to business, it applies to the arts. And we've been terrible at reaching artists. It also applies to psychology. We've been terrible at reaching out to psychologists in the church. It's like, oh, well, they're doing a secular thing. And I remember a conversation that I had. I just drew a blank. He wrote the song, Our God is an Awesome, Rich Mullins. And I'm talking to Rich, and he goes, there is no secular music. It's all sacred music. Now, it can be sacred in a negative way. It can dishonor God. But music itself is a gift from God. And I got to thinking about that. Again, we talk about a little bit in this book, but I've unpacked it elsewhere. Imago Dei, that I'm made in the image of God, that he took his characteristics and put it in me. What does that mean? If you look at the characteristics that define humans as differentiated from animals, and some of them are the same. We eat, we sleep, we defecate, we procreate. But there are some characteristics that animals do not do. Language, music, art, organization. Those are the most mundane attributes of our day, like our time orientation. You got up this morning, you looked at your clock, first thing. Everybody does. Why? We think it's a very human thing to do. It's actually part of the divine nature in us to be concerned about time and future and events. So having said that, leadership in itself, the desire to organize for the betterment of a group, is a divine nature in us. There is no secular leadership, period. Now, there's leadership that dishonors God, but leadership itself is a divine bent in us. And there's some practices that secular leaders, because they focus on that, have actually developed their spiritual gift better than pastors have. I want to be careful as I say that, because pastoral leadership is powerful and influential. It is culture forming. But often, because the church has run away from society, we have led in these silos of religiosity rather than in the throes of where people are actually living. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's always just like an interesting conversation, interesting topic. And I was just curious as to how you respond to that as you're doing that, because I know obviously having a 18 campus, 48,000 person church requires a significant amount of business savvy or leadership savvy and going through some of that.
Let me put an addendum on that as well, Andrew, because when I did my PhD dissertation, it was on the politics of Jesus. Mm. And people go, well, Jesus isn't political. Really? Then why was he crucified? Because that is a political statement. Why did he do a triumphal entry, as all governors did when they entered into a city? He was political to the core, but the reason we don't think of him as political is because of the use of power. The deep dive I did on this, and it's reflected slightly in the book, is leadership in the world's eyes is using power for two things: either self-promotion or self-protection. Self-promotion, self-protection. And Jesus said that's illegitimate. The only legitimate use for power is for service and sacrifice. He has power. He has an identifiable group of followers. He has an agenda. He has a platform. All of that is the core definition of political. So he was a political leader. But the reason he feels so different to us, and here's where the tension is. I'm now answering the question. The tension is we think of power as using it to make money, which is self-promotion, or for self-protection, self-preservation. And Jesus said, nope, that's illegitimate. Power is only to be used for the powerless. That is the definition of servant leadership. And in every industry now, servant leadership is the ticket to success. And there is, and I can say this authentically because this is what I dug into my dissertation. There was no leader prior to Jesus that practiced servant leadership. Zero, none. And so we have titles like civil servant. That comes straight from Jesus. Or when we talk about serving others or servant leadership, even the, what do they call the Great Britain, the prime minister. That's a term from servant leadership.
Yeah, that's good. You open your book talking about just integrity and identity as well. So Jesus' identity and his relationship with the Father. I'd love to unpack just a little bit further, because sometimes leaders just get stuck in the ability to delegate authority or delegate responsibilities or raise other leaders up, and probably tied to just their self-consciousness or lack of confidence in their identity in Christ. Can you talk about a little bit about that, of like what keeps leaders from like helping to promote other people, right? So using your power, your position, just to stay self-promoting, to maintain that I can do it better than everybody else, but being able to leverage the opportunity to release authority and to raise other leaders up and tying that to our identity in Christ.
Yeah. The first two chapters, I'm going to pull those together because it deals with the identity of Jesus. And it really comes out of Mark chapter 1, verse 1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, Christ, Son of God. So those are both political titles of Jesus, one for the Jews, one for the Romans. You have this title, Son of God, which is quite exalted. It's still true. I mean, very true. And then Jesus called himself Son of Man. And he was the only one to call himself Son of Man. That's a title of diminution or humility. That's the biblical side. Let me talk about from my personal side. When I was teaching at Ozark, and as a former student, you probably heard this. My greatest criticism when you got those class evaluations was, I mean, they liked the class, good content. He's a hard grader. But the criticism was, he's arrogant. Andrew, I have never been arrogant. I've been insecure. And when I present myself as arrogant, the using big words or these exaggerated stories or this larger than life personality, it comes out of a deep sense of insecurity in myself where I'm not sure I'm worthy to be on the stage that I'm on. When you have that insecurity, you will compensate with bravado. Mm. I've tested this with hundreds of leaders. And we have leaders. I just had lunch with a Navy admiral yesterday. Phenomenal leader. In this current environment, I'm bumping against all these leaders, field testing this idea. And to a man, to a woman, they're saying, yes, when we come across as with bravado is because of an insecurity. That's why this dual side of having absolute confidence in who you are as a child of God, an absolute commitment to the purposes of God to call yourself Son of Man. I'm going to take this role, but only so that I can serve you and protect you. That identity is theologically based in the fatherhood of God. Now, in our cultural setting, our identities come from our earthly fathers. Now, there are other people who feed into it. And a lot of people don't have a dad and still have great identities because of a father-like figure. But the father that God gave us on earth is only a stepping stone to get us to him easier. Now, if you don't have a father, you can still get to the heavenly father. But it is the identity that we derive from God the Father that empowers us to serve humbly the people that God has put in our stewardship. If you miss that, then you will wind up leaning into the Son of God, or, you know, I'm like a semi-divine figure in my organization rather than Son of Man. You have to have the confidence to stand on the platform and the authority as a Son of God. But without the Son of Man, that is your title for yourself, you will never be able to achieve servant leadership. That's a pretty good summary of the first two chapters of the book.
Yeah, that's awesome. If I can, how old are you now, Mark?
61.
61. So, I mean, it was 13 years ago, you know, teaching at Ozark and things of that nature, and just kind of getting those reviews and just that self-awareness of the insecurity and things of that. How did that come about, of just the awareness of like, I present like this because I'm insecure, and how can we encourage leaders to be more self-aware in that ability to be less self-promoting and more on the proactive approach of being able to raise up other leaders and encourage and empower them to do what God's called them to do?
Yeah. Let me give a couple answers if I could. I would say, short answer, I became wise in my early to mid 40s. It just takes time. A young man is a young woman is going to want to be aggressive and build your career. After that, you need to attend to building your character. And the problem is, if you don't build your character before you build your career, you can build a career and destroy the relationships that are all around you. That didn't happen to me because I had some self-awareness, but it is, how did it come about? Some of it is just time. The other part of it is, when I would get those reviews, I would take it to different men in my life that I expected to say, well, that's stupid because they're dumb. The pivotal moment was with Dick Gibson. I was at a CIY conference. A woman in her mid-60s critiqued one of my messages. I had given some humor that wasn't inappropriate, but it was unnecessary. I talked about this woman dressed in leather pants, and I'm driving by in an airport and she's bent over. And I said, you know, I was just talking about, you know, the temptations that are before us. And this woman very kindly said to me, you know, you're a good enough communicator. You don't need any off-color humor. And I said, well, you old biddy, you don't even have a right. Like, you shouldn't even be at the conference. You're too old. So I go to Dick and I said, hey, here's what this woman said. He was the first person to call me out. And he didn't really criticize me. He said, Mark, if it's true, then change. If it's not true, then let it go. And I thought, I need someone in my life who will tell me the truth. And so I asked him to be an accountability partner. And that led to not only years of accountability partners, which I still have, but also years of discipling young men to help them. So I took it a twofold approach. One is, I need to surround myself with men who will tell me the truth about me. And I need to surround myself with young men that I can speak truth into. Recently, as in the last 4 years, I did something, Andrew, and it's in the book. It's one of the exercises in the book. Probably the most painful thing I've ever done. I did a blind spot survey, where I put a 3x5 card, 3 different questions, and I gave it to 12 different staff members from different levels of our organization, different places in the organization. And I invited them to speak into me what I might not be seeing. Question number one, something like, what do I do that helps you do your job better that I may not even be aware of? What do I do that is a hindrance to me? Or what do I do that is either shooting myself in the foot or is a hindrance to you doing your job better? Third question was, if you were my supervisor, what advice would you give me about my character development? Now, don't do it if you don't want honesty. But I got honest feedback that was both reassuring, but also devastating. The devastation is what you need to destroy those character flaws in you that, look, you already know what your character flaws are, but you think, you think you're hiding them from other people because you're clever enough, and you're just not. And when you realize you're not fooling anybody, you can stop fooling yourselves about your deficiencies and then really go address them.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, being able to hear that feedback or want to hear that feedback is definitely a huge piece.
Can I say one more thing, Andrew? Because this is probably what made the biggest difference to my public reputation. Starting in about 2014, I started in every message giving some kind of public confession of weakness. Mm. Prior to that, I was pretty much the hero of all my own stories. And I remember hearing Kyle Eidelman preach with self-deprecation, and I would say, I just don't have those kind of stories. No, I was deceiving myself deliberately because I wasn't willing to do that. And what I discovered is the more, and this is when I do speech coaching, I try to offload this wisdom. Every time that you criticize yourself in public, people will praise you in private. Every time you praise yourself in public, people will criticize you in private. That's not just for preachers, that's for every leader. And I think that our current president is really struggling with that. If he would just come out and say, yeah, you know what, I was probably pretty tough on people, or yeah, you know, but he doesn't have the ability for any kind of public humility. If he did, I think it would be a game changer for his reputation publicly.
Yeah, that's interesting. You, one of the chapters in your book is titled Consistency. And I love this quote from that chapter. You say that there is no magic wand to wave, no secret sauce. Character comes through the monotony of small decisions stacked on top of each other. A leader's habit in the shadows ultimately evolve into character in the limelight. As the old adage says, your competency will take you only as far as your character will sustain you. And competency is seldom the leader's lid. Character is. Yeah. What are some of the habits that you currently have now, that these habits in the shadows that, because even like the conversation that we're having now, there's just like things that you're doing now a little bit older in life that you probably should have been doing in your 30s. Like what are some of those things that you could encourage leaders to do a little bit younger, like the receiving of feedback, but really just even personally, just your relationship, maybe even with the Lord? What are just some of the consistent habits for you in the shadows?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, because these are not stunning. I'm going to mention three. I floss twice a day. I didn't until probably I was 30 years old. And a friend of mine said, bro, you need to floss. And it was like, nobody likes to floss. I will do it twice a day, more after breakfast and before I go to bed. Not because of dental health, but because precisely because I don't want to do it. But it only takes like a minute. And if you can do something for a minute that you don't want to do, but you do it twice a day, then there are other things you don't want to do that it will leach into. I make the bed every day. I make the bed. It takes me about a minute and a half. It is when you can do something that you don't want to do for a minute and a half. I've also started this. Some of you are doing the same thing. I live in Arizona. In fact, I almost just moved right now because the shade of a palm tree is cooling me down. That's how weak I am. I hate being cold. So after every workout, I do a cold plunge. I'm not convinced that it helps. I don't see any benefit. The benefit is, and I do this, like I'm in there and I'm just cringing. And I just keep telling myself, I can do hard things. I can do hard things. I can do hard things. I go from the cold plunge then to a meeting with someone I don't want to meet. I give a critique or a conversation that's difficult that I don't want to have. I reach out to someone that I don't want to reach out to. If you can do simple things that are hard, that builds your muscle memory of doing hard things. Okay, so here are two things that I do have done for a long time that I think would be some of the best investment of your time. Every day I have a to-do list, which a lot of people do. Who cares? But in my to-do list, every day I rate them A, B, C, or D. A's are things that, these are items that will deliberately influence the, my character and competency further on. I decided what was my A when I was about 20 years old. I want to be a scholar that helps get deep thoughts accessible to the masses. That's who I want to be. I did that in the academy, and now I'm doing that in the church. I'm like the theological Yoda of CCV. Why? Because every day I did my A's. Part of those A's are reading Greek and Hebrew. No one has ever asked me if I read Greek or Hebrew today. No one, ever. But because I do it every day, I can do it naturally. And when one of our executive pastors, he pulled me in yesterday and said, hey, could we do this this thing on people living together? And I go, actually, I've already written it. Why? Because I'm doing my A's every day. So do your A's every day. Make a to-do list every day. And I don't care if you get your B, C's, or D's done. The challenge is your C's are usually your urgent events. Mm. So if you can begin to master the important over the urgent and do that every day. Here's another thing that, I've done. I write a letter of gratitude to every staff member, handwritten note, every year. You know, we have this year 500. It takes about an hour a week to do that. I hate doing it. But there's nothing fun about it. But what I recognize is if I can take 2 minutes to write it, to write a card to someone, and I don't just say thank you. I try to get specific. I even look up their personality profile. I look up their job description. I look up their hiring date. I look up their family members and their kids. And I usually write about 10 of those notes a day. Gratitude, a habit of gratitude, is more powerful than the time you invested in it. It has outsized advantage to the investment. So for me, the habits that you want to develop are those that have an outsized impact for the investment that you have to put in it.
Yeah, those are some great tips. Appreciate that. We talk a lot about being nimble in the church planting world. It's just kind of the nature of the job when everything is brand new, everything's up in the air. You have a chapter in your book titled Nimbleness. And again, one of the quotes that you say is, leaders, we need to recognize that the power that nimbleness brings to an organization is the difference between success and failure. Rarely do we ever win with our original strategy.
Right.
So you talk about humility that is required to be nimble. Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I wish Jeff were here because he's the one that has mastered that. For me, as I think through it, Andrew, I think the key to being nimble is humility. Well, there's a couple of keys. One is humility, because if you hold on to an idea so tightly that you don't let go of it, you're never going to be flexible enough to try something else. Humility also, and this is the second part of humility for nimbleness, is to ask other people questions. Don Wilson, the founder of CCV, he taught me this like nobody else. He interrogated everybody. Well, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? He always asked other people, like, What are your ideas? One time he went to the residence and said, I think it was like $100. I'm going to give you $100 for anyone who gives me the best idea of how to improve CCV. And there was this one young lady that we haven't done it, but it was just the creativity of it that got her the award. She said, if we could scan every car that comes into the parking lot, then we could measure attendance records based upon the license plate. Now, we can measure that if they check in a child. We can measure that if they volunteer. We register everything. But if someone just comes in, we don't have their picture, we don't have their phone number, we don't have their contact, we don't know who they are. And so asking questions of multiple people will help you think outside your own box. But you have to be humble enough to say, as a leader, my job is not to have the best ideas. My job is to pull the best ideas out of the people around me. Here's the, so that humility is a key to nimbleness. Here's the other key is margin. Sabbath is essential. And I'll just be honest, Andrew, I didn't take a Sabbath when I was at Ozark. I just figured, well, you know, we don't have classes on Monday. And I still worked on Monday, but, and then I preached on the weekend. I didn't even know about holidays, like President's Day in those days. Oh, I get holiday. I'm still going into work. Such a mistake. I have been far more effective here at CCB because it's a high value. Friday is a sacred day to me. And I'm going to be making sawdust in my wood shop on Friday. I'm not going to be looking at a sermon, even if I'm preaching. I'm not going to be doing email. In fact, I don't look at email from Thursday afternoon when I leave the office until Monday morning. And nobody's died yet. Like, I don't have scars on my wrists. I can't save the world. But if I don't have margin in my life, margin is where the best things happen. Like, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but every miracle of Jesus was an interruption. Like, there was nothing, there was none of them that were planned. And if you don't have the emotional, financial, time, intellectual margin, then you will not take advantage of the opportunities that come your way. And so there's part of nimbleness that is adjusting when you hit a brick wall. There's another part of nimbleness when you jump through an open window.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. I appreciate a lot of that, because we talk a lot about in church planting world, just the tension of inviting people in to speak into the vision and really believing that vision should be a team sport and all of that. But at the same time, we also have this conversation of not wanting to abdicate our leadership as a leader of an organization. Right. And so there's a tension there of maybe even the self-promotion a little bit, but also just the humility of being open to other ideas or changing when somebody else has a better idea than you do. But it's just it's an interesting tension in all of that.
Yeah. If I could, Andrew, I want to speak straight to you church planners that Andrew's helping to support. Every leader isolates because it's your responsibility to take on the burden of the congregation. And Ashley, who is our senior pastor, he is a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. I would take a bullet for him. He isolates. I mean, part of that's necessary, obviously. But on several occasions, I've said, bro, do not rob me of the opportunity to stand as your shield. Do not rob me of an opportunity to hold up your arm in the battle. Do not rob me of an opportunity to take a shot that you have to take. Let me be your rear guard. There are people all around you that would jump off a cliff for your vision. Do not rob them by holding your emotional vulnerability to yourself, your pain to yourself, your challenges to yourself. To not delegating tasks is one thing, but delegating emotional pain is far more rare in leaders. You will never be nimble if you are holding the mantle alone and not sharing your burdens, your pains, your joys, and your fears.
Yeah, that's a good word. So we talk a lot about in the first half of your book, just a lot of the character is just the foundation of leadership. And then more in the second half, you kind of get into just very practical, tangible things of how to do XYZ, cast vision, develop strategy, things of that nature. And I love your vision or your chapter on vision, because I do a lot of work with church leaders in this area. And I recently spoke to a pastor who was wrestling with the idea of trying to, like, do we need like some bigger kind of a vision more than just making disciple makers? And to his credit, like, they had a well thought out like discipleship strategy that they were running, but he was struggling with the tension of a need to have a bigger call, something deeper than just making disciples. And I'm curious, within the casting of vision or the purpose of why we need a vision or why should we have a vision, or is he right in his assessment of maybe it's just about making disciples? I'm curious as to how you would have gone on to that conversation and what you would have said to him.
Yeah. As you articulated that, the making disciples, it's too generic to be a clear vision. I mean, it's the command of Jesus. Obviously, it's the last thing he ever said is to go into the world and make disciples. So that sin quo non, that is our mission. But the mission and the vision are not the same. Your vision is of a preferred future. So let me share ours, and then I'll unpack why I think a specific big grand vision matters. Our vision is to reach the entire valley for Jesus Christ. We do that with our mission by winning people to Christ, training believers to become disciples, and sending disciples to impact the world. So that's vision, the preferred future, and then the mission is the specifics to accomplish that. The Phoenix Metro Valley is the fifth largest metro area in the United States, has over 5 million people in it. As of this month, we have an average in-house attendance on our campuses of 50,000. And people go, 50,000, that's bigger than our city. We do not think we're a big church because we don't measure the people who come. We measure the people who don't. We are reaching 1% of the Phoenix metro area. That should never be sufficient for anyone. Now, other churches, we have got a lot of other great churches, okay? Together, we are reaching all the churches in the Phoenix metro area. We are reaching approximately 17% of the valley. 17%, that means 73% or 83% are going to a Christless eternity. Or at least to say they don't have a local body of Christ that they're involved with, which vastly increases your chance of a Christless eternity. So how in the world can we be complacent with 50,000? It is not the strategies that are going to get us there. It's the vision that will get us there. So I'll just tell you a couple of things that have happened in recent years at CCV that really showed us why most visions are insufficient. Most visions for churches are internal oriented rather than external oriented. It's more of a portrait than a vision. A vision is out there. A portrait is in here. We decided to help at one Christmas. We decided to take up an offering to help other churches. So we said to our church that we're going to take up this offering. We're going to call it More Than Us. And every penny you give is going to go to another church. Now, we're going to vet them, but churches can apply to us for funds that you are going to give. We expected probably a $2 million offering. It was a $7.5 million offering. Our people affirmed a vision that was external more than internal. And it just took our breath away. That they were proud to be able to help other churches. They're loyal to CCV, but they recognize that when you have your eyes up and eyes out, when your vision is, most discipleship ministries as they're developing church are, how do we build our own people up? And pardon me if I'm skeptical, but so many discipleship ministries are Bible study oriented. That is, Bible study is not discipleship. And look, no one's going to criticize me of not knowing, loving, and chasing after the Bible. The Word of God is my life. But that's not discipleship. Discipleship is hands and feet more than head and ears. And so simply teaching more people the Bible, the reason that's so attractive to pastors is because that's what we do best, and that's what we know best, and that's what affirms us best. Mm. If your insecurity, going back to chapter one, if you are insecure in your role, you're going to primarily define discipleship as what makes you the expert that other people have to come to you. Until our vision is outward focused, it's not going to impact the city and probably won't grow our church. Fast forward. That was, by the way, 3 months before COVID. And this $7.5 million, many of the projects that we vetted, they said, it doesn't matter now because we can't build the building because no one's coming to the building. Could we divert the funds to online video presentation of the gospel? Which, of course, absolutely, yes. Let's help you do that. Our video crew and a production team went to dozens of churches to help them master this. So what the $7.5 million actually was way more influential because of COVID. Post-COVID, what are we struggling with? Mental health issues. So we took up another offering. And we said, we're going to take up an offering and we're going to pay for 80% of the mental health resources that anyone needs. You don't have to be a CCV member. Like if you live in the Phoenix metro area, you are part of our vision. So we paid, I believe it was $3.5 million to mental health care for people. Some, many were members of our church, many were not. When your vision exceeds the boundaries of your organization, that's when you really begin to get traction and see the strategies that will take you beyond where you are now.
Dude, that's so good. We man, we talk a lot about just intentional disciple making and just moving beyond just the head knowledge into the hands and feet. And I feel like we could just pause and unpack that for another couple of hours. But I really love that you kind of brought that up. And just the art and intentionality behind having a big compelling vision that really just captures the heart of your people to want to be on board. I struggle because I'm currently attending a church where we have a lack of some of that right now. And it's just like, man, if you could just get up, and I've talked to the pastor, if you could just get up and share a big dream, like you would unlock so much sacrifice financially, time-wise, and resources that the people have to be able to want to see that vision, just to be bigger, a part of something bigger than themselves. And I love that we have an opportunity to kind of share some of that. But you also talk in the intentionality of visioneering, and you say, like, if you in the book, like, if you can't create space for visioneering, yep, you will sentence yourself to management as a substitute for leadership. And then you kind of go on, it's like visioneering, like, takes intentional amounts of time, like a couple, yep, of days a year, a couple of days a month, like all of these different things that you kind of lay out. But what would you say to a young pastor or maybe a leadership team who is just quote unquote too busy to take time to really invest in the vision of the church? And maybe like that ABC list or that C-level list of just the urgent becomes way more important than it needs to be. How would you kind of talk somebody through just the need to invest in the time that it takes to create vision?
Yeah. Let me give you just some practical talk right now. So if you're a church leader, if I could, I would forbid you from ever saying I'm too busy, because that's a lie. And you know, it's a lie. I have 24 hours a day. You have 24. And like everybody has 24 hours a day. Your problem is not time. Your problem is priorities. That's number one. Number two, God wants you to Sabbath. He wants you to Sabbath daily with 8 hours of sleep. And if you're not getting that, like, you are shooting yourself in the foot. If you don't have time for physical exercise, for prayer, for Sabbath, and for 8 hours of sleep a day, then you are doing something that someone else wants you to do, not God. So just be honest about that. Every time you say, I'm too busy, you are admitting a bit of idolatry, because you have raised someone else's vision or someone else's purpose or someone else's values above God's for you. So let's get really honest and just say, I'm a coward. I'm too afraid to say no to an elder. I'm too afraid to say no to a friend. I'm too afraid to say no to a family member. Let's just be really honest. If you're saying I'm too busy, you are saying someone else is usurping the priorities of God in my life. And that's because I'm a coward. I can't say no. That could help us get started, right?
Right.
So now you need to ask, and I think we do a helpful job with this in the book, about what are you doing that you don't need to be doing? What are you doing that someone else could be doing? The primary thing that all of us should be doing is what only you can do. And I don't think I got into the book with this, but I'm assuming I'm talking to some younger guys here. Andrew, I've kind of developed a template to, as I coach young guys in their professional path, of how to think through their, how much of their job they're going to love and how much they're going to hate. Okay. You should never take a job where you hate more than 50% of it, but every job has the crap in it. My first job was at McDonald's. It was a lot of crap, but I should never have taken that job if I didn't enjoy 50%. That's in your 20s. In your 30s, it should probably be, I don't know, 40, 60. I don't like 40%, love 60. Your 40s, it should go to 30, 70, 30, 50, 80, 20, and 60s, 90, 10. You should earn the right to do what only you can do. Now, here's another. I stole this from Craig Groeschel, who stole it from someone else. Earlier in your career, you grow through your yeses. Later in your career, you advance through your nos. So the younger you are, the more, like, you're going to have to say yes to speak at a camp if you want to be a nationally known speaker. You're going to have to say yes to a leadership meeting if you want to be a key leader. But the older you are, and not just chronologically, but the older you are in the organization, the less you should be doing that other people expect you to do, and the more you should be doing only what only you can do. And if you're the point leader, there's fewer of those than you think. There are other people who can create an agenda for the meeting. There's other people who can do primary recruitment calls.
Yeah, that's good. One of my favorite chapters was towards the end of the book, called Take Action. Mm. And in that section on the Great Commission, really, you just talk about how making disciples is the mission of every church and every Christian. But you also talk a lot about the contextualization of living out that mission personally, and as well as corporately, even in the business world. You go on to say, and I loved this quote, and I'd love to hear you just kind of unpack it a little bit more. You say, perhaps the single most important role of a pastor is to apprentice non-pastoral professionals to use their vocation as a ministry and to turn their home into a church.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about just the unique nature of just seeing your vocation as just the mission field that we're kind of going into, but specifically to the job of the pastor to equip people to be that missionary or to be that that person. There's a lot there that I just would love to hear you just kind of just talk a little bit more about.
Yeah, so you church planners, you are in a unique vocation, and there are at least three, maybe more, but these three in particular, where you are always the expert: a pastor, a policeman, a physician, and a Bible college professor or a college professor. Like, you're always the expert. So everyone's telling you, yes, yeah. And you think you're the smartest person in the room. When you go into a hospital, people say, well, should I get this cancer treatment? You don't know. You're a pastor. You're not a physician. Quit acting like you're a physician, a lawyer, a scholar, a life coach. You're not. You do what only you can do. And that is to help people think spiritually about their vocations. So let me, after that exhortation, let me give you an example. Ryan went with me to Nepal. We have created a mission trip that I think is the perfect mission trip. One of our CPAs, he's a finance guy, made so much money, he told God, tithe is not enough. So, God, where do you want me to serve in the world? I want you to show me some of the poorest people in the world and what their physical need is, and they have least access to the gospel. He ran across Nepal, has more water per capita than any country in the world, and none of it is potable. To dig a well in Africa is $4,500. To dig a well in Nepal is $1,500. So he just went over there and started digging wells. Every well creates a church. So he has another guy that, after the church is established, and it's not an official church, It's illegal to preach the gospel in Nepal. So this guy's willing. He's a bivocational pastor, willing to sacrifice and maybe persecuted to present the gospel. Okay, so that's the setting. And so Matt comes to me and goes, how do I get more people to know about this? I said, are you kidding me? You're in the Himalayas. You invite a group of guys to come, each of them pay for a well, each of them do leadership training for pastors that are preaching at those wells, and then we'll take a 3-day hike in the Himalayas. It is like, even as I'm saying this, you're going, well, I want to go. I want to be a part of that, to spend 3 days hiking the Himalayas. Oh, we end, by the way, at Mount Everest View Hotel, 14,000 feet. And in order to get back to Kathmandu on time, we have to take a helicopter and fly over base camp. Sorry. Right. So this is like a manology. And what I do, I am interested in helping people of Nepal, but that's not my primary goal. My interest is in seducing high influence men in their careers, and this happens to be a men only trip, to then come back and make a difference. Ryan works for Ping Golf Company. He's the head engineer. Scary smart, pretty quiet. And it was funny. I was we were in Saudi Arabia on a layover going to Kathmandu. And some guy in line in front of me is like bragging, going, yeah, I'm coming over here to play golf. I said, oh, what clubs do you swing? And he goes, Ping. And I go, that guy designed him. It was like, it was one of those mic drop moments where, yeah, you're not that important. Anyway, Ryan goes, has a great trip, and comes back and says, I need to devote my life, my engineering mind, to helping organize other trips. He is leading that trip this spring without me, without the head of the organization. That is one example of what we can and should do. We've had F-35 pilots. We've had major business leaders. They have expertise in their area, and you don't have to take them to Nepal to do that, but you do have to be deliberate in investing in them, because what they don't know is how to spiritually lead their families. Most business leaders cannot pray with their wife at home. But you know how to show them how to do that, for crying out. I'm like, my gosh, that's, you do that in your sleep. Most men, I met a guy in the gym 3 days ago. Like, this dude is ripped. And he's a trainer, and he's a professional athletic coach. And he said, man, could I get some time with you? Because I don't know how to read the Bible on my own. Dude, in 1 hour, I can help change your life with that. Let's take the top tier leaders and get the expertise that they have in our ministry, but also take our expertise for reading the Bible, for praying, for like, what is it? What are the important habits that you have to develop a spiritual life? You know that. So don't be insecure about what you know, and don't be overly secure about what you don't know. One last thing I'll say. CCV is a unique church, in that most churches spend about 60% of their budget for salaries and benefits. We are under 40% in salaries and benefits. We're actually about 38%. We want to get down to 35%. Why? Because we don't hire pastors to do ministry. We hire managers to help people do ministry with their skill sets. You have public school teachers in your congregation that would be phenomenal at organizing a curriculum and room development. You have carpenters and lawyers and engineers. Why do we think we have to do the ministry rather than facilitate the ministry for the body? Discipleship, if you want to get practical with it, it should be apprenticeship, not Bible study.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Mark, I'm so grateful for just the opportunity to unpack your book. The Master Leader, again, the 12 ways to lead like Jesus. That's available on Amazon or wherever else you want to buy that. Mark has a website, markmoore.org, a ton of resources and video resources and other books and things for sale on there. But Mark, I'd just love to have you close by any last call to church planters, to church leaders. Anything final to kind of encourage them? I know that you close your book and talking a lot about mentoring and things of that nature. And so just having a little mentoring moment to close our webinar together.
Yeah, well, I would invite any of you, if you want to learn what we're doing at CCV, we will ask you how to make it better, because we think that you have something to offer us. But if we have something to offer you, come down for a weekend. We'll roll out the red carpet and show you what we've got. I will say this, especially to church planters, the majority of the growth in the church is from new churches. The majority of growth in groups in our church is from new groups. So what you're doing is bold and brave. I never did it. I've always envied those of you who did. And so thank you for going and making Jesus famous all over the world. Could I pray for you?
Oh, please.
Holy Father, would you infuse in these men and women a passion for a greater vision, for a deeper humility? Help them to trust what you've said about them, that they are your children, that your hand is on them. And just as Jesus held the seven candlesticks in his right hand, the seven stars of the seven churches in his right hand, those are the angels of those seven churches. Not the angels of heaven, the angels on earth, the men and women who are leading those churches in Asia Minor. Would you put your fingerprints all over these men and women so that today they would sense your presence in a unique and extraordinary way, and put on their mind other men and women that they could mentor to be the hands and feet of Jesus where they live? We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you, Andrew.